something that I was doing intuitively, but wasn't paying attention to, so I wasn't doing it consistently. And I attribute a significant amount of why people like my writing and my success to it, is paying attention to the promises you make readers at both a macro arc level and a micro chapter by chapter level, making sure that you meet them and that you pay them off. You know, just before you start a chapter, jot down, what are the promises I want to make in this chapter? What are the payoffs I want to have in this chapter? And what do I want people to be excited for?
This is the Crit RPG Podcast, your one-stop shop for everything Lit RPG, Progression Fantasy, and Royal Road.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Crit RPG Podcast, the only podcast that literally rocks your socks on. with me today is Bacon McLeod, and if you're only listening and not watching, he's chosen a sock puppet as his avatar for the video. So if you want to, you can also like take a quick gander at YouTube to see what that's like. So hi, Bacon, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm going well. Enjoying my Saturday evening.
Yeah. So you're writing Runeblade. A story that had various titles over subtitles over the rise on Rising Stars.
It was fun to bring Title Wars back for a bit after a wee while. Yeah. So there's a little bit of context behind that. In that I have been a reader in this space for an exceptionally long time. So I am 28. And I started reading sort of progression fantasy and progression fantasy adjacent things in a web serial format when I was about 15 or 16, which is a long time. I think, like a lot of people, one of the very first ones that sort of brought me into the space was Mother of Learning. I've basically been on Royal Road. Not Mother of Learning, Legendary Moonlight Sculptor. Both have a name in there. I've been on Royal Road, although that said, I have read Mother of Learning since one of its first chapters, which is also like a decade old. But I've been on Royal Road since like the very beginning, and I'm a voracious reader, so I've seen a lot of the shifts in the space. And one of the things from years ago that stuck with me really heavily was when Mark of Time and 12 Miles Below, 12 Leagues Below, the ice one with the robot knights. Yeah.
12 Miles Below, yeah.
Yeah. That, love that book. That's really cool. I've only read the first two. Yeah. When they were both on Rising Stars, they did Tidal Wars. And then for like 3 or 6 months afterwards, this must have been 3-4 years ago, it was just like a continuous thing that people were doing. And then it obviously, you know, their tools got flogged and it just faded from existence. And then, you know, I was having some pretty explosive glory from Rising Stars. I'd expected to kind of, you know, do all right. But I did not expect to do quite this well. And keeping in lockstep with me the entire way was Path of Pen with The Lone Wanderer. And we'd started chatting. It must have been like a day or two into Rising Stars. I helped him set up his Patreon. You know, we just yarned about everything, the like day-to-day stresses of Rising Stars, our strategies, what we wanted to do. And then, you know, in one of our conversations, I was like, oh my God, we should do Tidal Wars. And he was like, what the hell is that? And I explained it to him. He got a little freaked out because he was like, yeah, a lot of people hate it. And I was like, man, this is going to go amazing and be really funny. Because it was like, obviously there's an awareness that doing something like that brings more eyeballs, but it was much more that as somebody who's being around for that long, I found it really, really funny the first time it was done. So I like hunted down an old Reddit post that took me like 6 hours to find. Somebody had screenshotted it, and I was like, see, this thing. and we spent like a day coming up with quotes. and then we did it. It got more attention than I expected. But what I found really funny is that one of the writers' discords I'm on, what I didn't actually realize is one of the people that I interact with regularly was the writer of Mark of Time. One of the original people did it, who then immediately ruthlessly teased me for it. And then like a day into it, I think the author of 12 Miles Below commented on one of my fictions, just like one line, like, oh, and some shenanigans I see. And I was like, oh no, in court.
Nice.
They know I'm That's a cool. shameless hack. but it was great fun. I really enjoyed doing it. I think we sort of, had our fun with it and then nipped it in the bud before it kind of got boring and exhausting.
Yeah.
I got to do the, I can't actually remember if I did it or not, but I wanted to make like a, I don't feel so good in this to start joke as like the malice of rising stars kicked in with MALUS. So like the algo when it starts, it's like it's something arcane, like after 21 days you start getting pushed down or whatever. I can't remember if I made that joke for a different one, but it was all good fun.
Yeah, pretty good. I enjoyed it a lot. Yeah. I think because I checked out that Discord that you mentioned, and I think one of the first comments I saw off you was like that you were doing Title Wars-ish, that sort of stuff. And that actually got me to like check out Rising Stars and actually see that your story was on there. Nice. So it's a bit like backwards.
Yeah. What I found actually most amusing about it is that I think it was a progression camp separate on somebody posted a screenshot. The first one that got a lot of engagement and both me and Pastel, but like our view game skyrocketing. And I was like, oh, that's neat. Didn't really expect that to happen. But then when we started like switching them regularly to keep making jokes, especially when he passed me, somebody posted a screenshot again and there were like five different comments accusing both posters of like being our alts. Like us doing it for guerrilla marketing. And it's like, no, but the fact that you think this has been so successful, but the only way it could have happened is by us going through like nefarious marketing schemes was very entertaining to me and very flattering as well.
and like, what kind of like nefarious marketing scheme would that be entertaining? Like, how dare you write an entertaining book? Yeah. Like I don't know, like what some people must expect. Like, a couple of friends recently had the same experience where people are like, this is amazing. I refresh this book every single time. Like, I refresh Roy Wood for this. This is great. I love reading this. The characters are amazing. 4 stars.
Oh, yeah. I had that.
And you're like, 4 stars is like below average. The people do not realize this. Like, that's below average.
I had one that was so egregious that I think, A, it was a genuine mistake, and B, I think somebody reported the review because it then randomly disappeared, where somebody wrote me a glowing review of like, I love this story. It's amazing. I like this aspect. I wish I had the money to subscribe to Patreon. I really want to read more. 0.5 stars.
That must have been a mistake. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But it was still really funny. Like, I've had other ones, you know, where I understand there are some people who hold to the fervent belief that a average novel is 3 stars, like a relative star rating, where like, you know, 3 is the median and then, you know, 4 is amazing, 4.5 is amazing, and there's 1 or 2 5 stars, or maybe they don't even exist on Raw Road because they don't read it and meet a nebulous quality set.
And if that were true, you would be like, people would be reading a lot more 3-star stories.
Yeah, and it's definitely one of those things where it's like, I understand your position. I don't agree with your position. I wish the world worked
it's just
how
wrong.
You think it does. but it doesn't. But ultimately, like, it's not something where I'm like, I have had the grace to have gotten really good ratings. And I think it's also one of those things in my mind where everyone deals with that. So in a general sense, everyone's average is pulled down by the same anchor, which is, you know, the drug buy ratings, the people who had different beliefs about how the rating system works. Everyone experiences it roughly to the same degree. So I don't let it weigh on me in terms of like, they ruined my true rating. Whereas it's like, if you look at it in that, that's just how people rate and it happens to everyone, it kind of is still my true rating because that's dispatched into the equation.
It kind of is true, but also kind of isn't. There's a herd mentality. Mm. It's a broken it's broken window syndrome.
Yes, right? That is true.
So if the first rating you get is like a 3-star, people are gonna read your story like it's a 3-star story, and they're gonna find all the faults, and they're gonna be like, oh, why did someone hate this? They don't go in going like, why does everyone love this? And read the story as like, oh, this is great. Oh yeah, of course I can see people everyone loves it. It's like 5 stars. Go ahead. They go like, oh, yeah, I can see how this characterization isn't good. Or I can see how this plot point isn't good. Yeah, 3 stars is valid.
Right? I think
it is.
It's definitely
there's a herd mentality.
Yeah, there's definitely a case of that, and it's one of the things I think that I've been quite lucky with, is that every single sort of mediocre review and like the odd bad one I've gotten, all follow similar beats, and you know, it's a foolish idea to draw conclusions on the basis of individual reviews, but you can do some analysis on a collection of them. And basically from what I can tell is that there are a segment of readers who much more prefer rational style fiction, which is understandable. I like rational fiction. I like a lot more than rational fiction, but there are subsects of readers who that is the yardstick that are used to measure things by. Yeah. That is what they like. That is how they use to measure characters, story, narratives, plot beats, all of that. So a lot of them, you know, they're like, these things happen, 3 stars. Because while everything's cool, I don't like, you know, that there is essentially my book's just a bit too microwave for them.
Too microwave?
No, Michael Bay.
So, oh, Michael Bay, okay.
I have a fun anecdote about Michael Bay we can save for later when we have a space to talk about it.
But I mean, like, that's like going to a Japanese restaurant and saying the carbonara is bad.
Yeah, it's true. It is. And especially I do find it funny because I have tried my absolute I went through 12 iterations of my blurb and my What to Expect. I'm getting a lot of feedback on them. And a big part of the energy I put into my What to Expect was 100% centered around signposting extremely clearly what sort of story name is, which is it's a straight shooting limited RPG that plays it straight. And it is Hollywood, I guess you could say. It doesn't mean that the characters are supposed to be dumb. It doesn't mean any of that. But what it does mean is that it leans towards a battle of over explosions instead of the rigorous analysis of how doing this really dumb and shrapnel will kill you. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now that you mentioned that, I think I should be judging my book less harshly because I do nothing of that. Like what I do is like a lot of introspection, right? So people like think like, why am I thinking this? Like what's going on here? Or kind of like exploring why people think the way they think. That's fun to me. And I don't think that the readers who enjoy that are on Royal Road.
Yeah, they are. So, like there's some truly amazing books that I've read that even from a progression focused lens just don't get the draw that they have. So like, I'm just going to name them because I would love to give them a bit more attraction. There's two books that I really like that
merchant
very crap prolific, and very well written, have a lot of content, but are still hanging around somewhere between 400 followers. One of them I followed for years. One of them I've been reading for about 6 months. I actually shouted out one of them as my first shout out, and I'm going to shout out the other one when I get to the end of my initial stream of shout outs and kind of taper it back to things that I are like less of a marketing focus lens and more on a, you know, genuine sort of I enjoy this or check out my friend's thing. Sort of wins. One of them is Spies Spych, and one of them is the Homunculus Knight. And so both of those
Can you say it again?
Spire, as in like tower spire. Spires Spych. And the other one is the Homunculus Knight. Now, both of them, I think, definitely suffered a little in that they both definitely launched without an understanding of how to best launch on Railroad, you know? For example, the Homunculus Knight, I actually hit the guy up and I was like, hey, you might have slightly slower progression than standard, but this is fundamentally progression fantasy. You should really have that tag because it's very, very important on this website to have either progression or lit RPG or cobbled action on your level, especially when you do the vid category. So also both...
Both covers are super off meta.
Super off meta. So both of them are relatively more introspective. For example, Spire Spot is more character focused than standards on Raw Rage. Homunculus Knight is also character focused, but is relatively more introspective and a bit closer in pacing to traditional mythicity. But both of them are fundamentally books that people who like good books on Raw Rage would really enjoy. But
I mean, because Homunculus Knight has book covers with stained glass stuff on it, so I'm already a fan.
Yeah. No, it's awesome. Both of them are really good. So like a quick high level overview. Spy is like gutter rat kids who go through this world where there's multiple towers and they each have like a certain number of floors. And they have like very, I think, well, also for most people, like non-traditional power structures. Both of them are a bit slower pace. For example, in the Spire Spike one, he's like if you took a rogue from D&D that was focused on the utility aspects rather than the stabby assassin aspects, immediately off meta, you know, but done really well. Yep. He's like
bad choice, bad MC, 0.5
stars. Yeah, exactly. And like the Homunculus Knight is like the progression isn't clearly signposted, but it's like there. And then because they both have these like slower pacings and slow starts, it just doesn't like immediately hook people, despite them being really good. And you see that all the time. Like people are like, why is this doing badly? And it's just off meta is what you see most of the time.
Which brings me over to my first question. Because we are going so all over the place on this show right now.
That's fine. Yeah.
It is like because we've already done like shout outs and books that you love. But what I wanted to ask first before we got this like huge segue. So tell me about your book. What is it about and why should I be reading it?
So Runeblade is in a way, I guess where it started was that there was a specific type of RPG that I really enjoy. And you see them come up every now and then. They're really entertaining. And they do well and they grab people. And from a reader perspective, I love them and I hence see them well. And normally where they fall along is being a relatively straight shooter in terms of like not necessarily trying to put a twist on things. It's not lit RPG about X. It's just the platonic ideal of a lit RPG. If I was to be so self-aggrandizing. And I hadn't seen one in a while. I wanted to write one. The fact that they do really well, you know, that is not a concern, but primarily it was that I really enjoy them, and I didn't have one to read at the moment. And that's sort of where Runevite started from. It's also started from a bit of my history, where there was the homage to the now. I think I fell into a sweet spot where starting in like a fourth death zone, isolated, went from fresh and new to being like a dead horse to not touch with a 9-foot pole. And I've come at the end of that, where it now is refreshing and quaint. But Runeblade is fundamentally, it's a boy with a mysterious background that he doesn't understand fully. He understands the consequences of it in broad strokes, but he doesn't understand the details, or know the details, I should say, who's been growing up in the woods with his father, training towards sort of one of the, you know, as all the RPGs have, like, my take or quirk, where there's a 5-year period where you can get your 10 general skills, cap them at 20, cap your stats at 20, and how well you do in that period influences the choices you get from your class. And he's been working on a legacy, which is this idea that you can merge general skills, their pre-existing recipes of general skills that this system knows. So it's not like you can take any mishmosh and slam them together with the right mindset and like the right mental framing and meditative power of awesome. There are aspects of that, but fundamentally, if you have the wrong skills, they don't merge. You can't remove general skills. So if you mess them up, you're screwed. He comes from a very old family where they have a perfect legacy where your 10 general skills merge into your first skill slot, and you have 9 that merge into your second, and on the way down your skill list. And they're hiding in the woods. The only reasonable explanation for this is that somebody knows that they have this knowledge, which is very valuable. The opening scene is them being found by a tracker. Caius has completed his first 2 skills. He's filled out his skill list for the 3rd skill, but he hasn't capped them all and merged them yet. And having to gain, I can't do the math off the top of my head, but 60 odd skills and merge them all and cap them at level 20 in a 5-year period, tough. Especially because his first skill took so long. And he has to flee. He ends up falling off a cliff. The bandits are almost toying with him. They're not trying to kill him. They're just trying to scare the crap out of him and then disable him, kidnap him. He jumps off a cliff instead of doing it over a waterfall. And at the base of that is a pool to the depths. And now the depths is kind of pulled from my idea of, again, like the platonic idea of a dungeon, where the entire world has this dungeon system underneath it. Not like physically in caves, but almost like a step adjacent to the world. Think of it, you know, in terms of like the Feywilds and D&D, where it's like a parallel sub-realm. But there are these portals all over the surface. Dungeon has many layers. Portals go to varying layers. And when he's got a broken maid and drowning in the waterfall, he ends up in the depths. And there is one crux to this problem. He doesn't have a class. He's not going to have a class for 2 years.
No.
And no one no one without a class has ever survived the Great Chaos. Yeah. And the only thing he does have is his knowledge and his family's legacy and what he needs to get to the end of it and learn all of these skills. And hopefully it's enough. And now in typical lit RPG happen, there's all these twisting turns and secret little power-ups he gets and lost pitch and things that play with it. But it's fundamentally a story about being trapped and trying to grow. But then also on the emotive side, the story about a boy who's grown up in severe isolation with his father as his only friend, aside from odd trips to the frontier villages on the outside of their forest home. And how he reacts and develops when faced with both a loss and also a situation that nominally is quite restrictive, a lot more restrictive in some senses, in that the dungeon is worse than the forest, but is also a lot more freeing in others, in that he has a lot more self-direction in the fact that he is now furthering his own goals rather than being driven towards a goal by his father. Now, he doesn't, for our skills, he'd be an idiot to do that. They're very rare. And anything else that he could do is a bit silly. But he's also been working towards a goal his whole life. And this sort of kickstarts it, where, to give context to this is all explained, I think, in the second chapter. In my world, there are sort of two main types of spell casting. There's raw casting, which is basically using like some type of mana manipulation skill that might be focused on a specific affinity. And then maybe you have a number of skills that passively or actively support your mana manipulation, sort of like meta magic, that sort of thing. And then you use that to freeform shape mana into effects. That's slow, requires a lot of concentration, and requires like physically channeling mana over time into workings. And then the other major style is sort of like more sorcery focused, where it's like having, you know, like a spell casting skill that you accrue spells for, that you also might have meta magic and other skills supporting it. But these spell forms, you physically channel mana over time. It's focus intensive, requires a lot of concentration. Both of those are relatively mutually exclusive from any form of melee fighting, because sitting there and like putting your fingers to your temples and focusing really hard is not what you want to do in a sword fight. I mean, you could try. I'm not sure how well it would go for you.
Rationalist fiction would say that.
And so Carlos has had this idea in his head bubbling away, that it's like, hang on, a big part of their legacy is there's like an aspect of it that's quite focused on runes. Traditionally in this world, most runes are focused on sort of formations, things like enchanting, big ritual circles, maybe making sort of items like a wizard staff that you can channel mana into, and it's got like reserve spell effects that you can activate, all that sort of thing, where it's very much either a artisan's skill set or it's the skill set of somebody who takes even more time than a traditional mage to prep the field. But he kind of pulled from a bunch of different things, you know, like the spell effects on staves, and the existence of passive body formations that he's very rare. But he's loved because one of the skills he needs to get is rune focus. And his dad is effectively like a master runer. And so he has this idea of like, what if you can bind spell formations onto your skin and like lock magic into it, so you get all of this channeling and all of this preparation you do with magic before you get into a fight, so that when you're in a fight, you can just like point your finger at somebody and go blam, and they does the spell. Because if you did that, then you could do that in a sword fight. He loves sword fighting. And it starts off as in sort of like an idle curiosity. And then his father helps him develop this idea. And then in the process of being in the dungeon, he gets to sort of self-actualize that development of spell casting in a form that he really likes. So, down, he's yet another spell sword, but he's the only spell sword in the setting. So,
yeah, I've been thinking hard about like how to make that interesting. But like, are there any little RPGs that people are like, nope, magic is dumb. No one should take magic. Like, readers are like, it's good that the MC isn't a spell sword. Like, I love that he just like goes ham with a hammer. Like,
I think I don't know. So you do see people that get bored of the archetype of the classical spell sword. I think the reason I've managed to avoid it is because, you know, if you boil them down to his bare essentials, he's still kind of a spell sword, but it's a different take on it. And I've tried to make it obvious that, you know, the style of magic he's using and developing and semi-pioneering, semi-getting supported through the system with has its own drawbacks. So if, you know, raw casting and material and like sorcery style casting has the drawbacks of it's focus intensive and it takes time to channel on all of this. You know, the positives of rune magic are that it's nominally very flexible and you don't need to channel, so you can instant cast things. But on the other side, it has like a massive upfront preparation cost.
Yeah.
Where, you know, A, that immediately means once he's burnt all the spells in the fight, that's it. It doesn't matter if his mana regenerates because he doesn't have time to sit down and scribble on his hand, you know?
Hold on for a second, yeah.
Yeah.
Look at that henna tattoo.
Yeah. Well, like a big inspiration for it was prepared casters that you see in tabletop, where, you know, at the start of the in-game day, you need to decide which spells you have from a spell list, and how many of each how many casts of each spell you have, and so that's the other in the universe drawback of it. Is it's like, okay, so you have to prepare everything, but what happens if you prepare, you know, a bunch of fire spells, and then before you can get time to reset everything, you come across a lava monster? Like, okay, you kind of screwed now.
Yeah,
and I think that's how
hot water.
Yeah, like I think what people don't like is not so much spell swords, but it's characters who are the best swordsman ever, and the best mage ever, and also the best alchemist ever. And there's no trade off for versatility. Obviously, like everyone secretly wants the main characters to be OP. At least most breeders. But there needs to be some veneer of trade-off there, at minimum, I think.
Yeah. I've been thinking about like one system that I just can't make work with a character that I wanted, to make it work with. But it's a longer story. So, second question. What's the best advice you've ever gotten as a writer?
Oh, I think that by far and away, I've received it from two people, but it's slightly differently. Fundamentally the same advice. It was something that I was doing intuitively, but wasn't paying attention to, so I wasn't doing it consistently. And I attribute a significant amount of why people like my writing and my success to it, is paying attention to the promises you make readers at both a macro arc level and a micro chapter level, and making sure that you meet them and that you pay them off. So like a really good example, of direct feedback that I got along those lines was in a couple of different cases. Say in my first few chapters, on my first iteration, for context, I've had a very close friend who I lived with. Actually, earlier we were talking about the first book I wrote. I lived with him at the time, and he gave me, he was basically I call him a beta reader, but he was really a developmental editor for me and helped massively. He's written short stories. They've done amazingly well. He's pointed this out on multiple occasions, but one point where it really stuck out was guys had like just landed in the depths, and he goes through, you know, his status and what's aware. And then he goes through this period where he's like, this place is really dangerous. I'm screwed. You've made a direct promise to the reader that this place is really dangerous. I'm screwed. And then, like,
and then,
Yeah.
And then you make the implicit like counter promise, like no one's ever gotten out of here without a class. And like obviously he's going to get out of there
The implicit promise is that there's gonna be some level of struggle there, right?
Yes.
At least in terms of like mentality of how he's approaching it should be like quite even if he does eventually like the way it is now, he starts off that way and he kind of stays that way, but he does morph into kind of like the love of battle aspects that you would expect. But originally he kind of for like the first 5 to 10 chapters just like repeatedly flip-flopped between oh fuck, this is really serious, and like la-di-da-di-da, lighthearted training role in terms of the tone of the way he was treating everything. So I got this like really direct feedback of like, you are making two promises here. Pick one. And so I picked one. And I got that same feedback from her, actually an author in our space. He's now become quite a close friend. The author of Die, Respawn, Repeat. So he's given me a couple of really good advices. Both was also the
isn't that Quetz?
Yeah, Quetz. Yeah.
Quetz is awesome.
He's given me some really good advice, both on, you know, pay attention to the promises you're making. He made those same comments on those other chapters in their original form. Less of them because that was post rework of showing it to my like original friend. Then there were two other bits of advice that played into that same thing and make pay attention to the promises you have. So the original form of my story, in my first chapter, you know, there's sort of like three sequences in it. It's like Caius having seen some bandits on a ridge, seeing that they're following him, running to his dad, getting to his dad, being told to bugger off. And then the sequence of his dad confronting the bandits and like trying to stall for time so that Caius can get away. And then there's the third sequence, which is like, Geist like actively being pursued with bandits right on his tail and then throwing himself off the waterfall. He used to start the waterfall chase scene. And so advice that like the implicit promise you're making is that there's all this really important stuff with his dad emotionally to ground himself in the world, but you haven't shown any of that. So that promise that you're making falls flat. So that's sort of like another dimension of it. If you're making a promise, you sort of need to show the grounding of it. And then the advice I got in general on how to actively do that as a tool, is to, you know, just before you start a chapter, jot down, you know, what are the promises I want to make in this chapter? What are the payoffs I want to have in this chapter? And what do I want people to be excited for?
Can a team of has-been teen idols save the world? Find out in the new series Boy Bands and Dragons. When Neverboyland is sucked into a magical world, their reunion takes a backseat to staying alive. But if they can get over the past drama that drove them apart, they may find that even pop stars can be heroes. Come and discover your new favorite read. Our comeback tour is Slaying Monsters, the first in the Boy Bands and Dragons series by Kim Smuga Otto, dropping on Kindle Unlimited October 25th.
Yeah. I'm still struggling a little bit because like I can't help but try to take some of this advice and kind of like run through my own story. When you mentioned the promises and basically the first sequence there, right? The showing the emotional attachment to his father. So in the first two versions of Torchbearer that I wrote, I had this problem where the main character just woke up somewhere without knowing what was going on. And the last thing that they remembered was them doing some sort of like big magic thing. That was the last thing that the reader remembered, but the character remembered something else. And nowhere had it been explained like where this main character came from and what the entire problem was and what the progress was. And people often wrote like, I feel as though I'm reading the second book in a series. I don't know where the first one is. I'm like, I have written the first one. It doesn't exist. So that for me was a big problem, because I, to this day, I still would not know how to make a promise to a reader that, yes, this character wakes up and they're not where they think they are, but it's not important for you to know this. Just enjoy the ride. I think that's like either super hard or impossible, because I have no way of, like, I thought about this really for a long time. But yeah.
Well, I think that's kind of analogous to where I started, where, you know, the initial confrontation with the bandits is to the narrative plot of the first book, relatively inconsequential. And even for the second book, where, you know, you start to explore, like, what happened, where, how, why. There was enough of that information in there to get that from the initial chase sequence and his reaction to landing in the depths. But that those added, I would say, maybe 1,500 words have nothing really to do with that, even though they look like that on the surface. They're much more to do with emotionally grounding the audience in why they should get about, you know, the fact that he has had to flee from his dad. Like, okay, so there's this implicit promise that this is really important to a character and is something awful happening. But there's no way to anchor that if you don't at least show very briefly. Like, there's no major exploration of his sort of initial relationship with his father. There's, you know, maybe 500 word interaction. And then there's maybe another 500 or 600 words of his father delaying and giving a bit of context about what they're being chased for. Narratively, plot wise, that's not doing much heavy lifting. Emotionally, it's grounding the entire impetus for Kai to want to get out of the depths.
Yeah, it's the. We talked earlier about this in the bonus material on Patreon. We're talking about the personal stakes, right? So why do we care if he gets out of the depths? Yeah, okay, I got that. Yeah, that's a good point.
And that's definitely some of the best advice I've had, is like paying attention to those promises and both, you know, are you promising something? How are you intending to pay it off? And if you're promising something, why should the audience care about that promise? And, you know, they're not things that are necessarily playing out line by line where it's going to fit to the chapter. But it's, you know, when I'm plotting something out, we were discussing earlier, you know, how I do a very rough outline of just descriptive terminology of what I expect to happen in the next, you know, 2 to 6 chapters. And then just write, see where it goes, generally veer completely away from it. But that sort of like primes me to think about, okay, like, what am I promising? When do I pay it off? How do I signpost?
Yeah, like my problem, yeah.
Yeah. How am I going to signpost it? And then when I'm actually writing, it's just like, I'm already digested what I'm going to do. And I just write stream consciousness. Like, often I find specifics of, you know, what he does or how a fight goes or the specific actions he takes or the line-by-line changes drastically. But the general vibe and direction stays the same, based around my understanding of the sort of premise I want to make and how I want to pay it off.
brings me to my next question. What's one thing that you learned while writing that you would change if you could, or that you do differently now?
Do we are we meaning more from like when I went live or since starting this project? Because I've got a response for both.
It's a coaching question, so you can decide.
So I think in terms of from when I just started writing this draft, kind of ties into the stuff I was saying previously, but being aware that there are structural elements to writing that you should pay attention to, that you shouldn't use as a blueprint, because structural elements aren't a blueprint, they're a toolbox. But a lot of writers, especially in spaces like this where we've come from being readers and really liking the stories, we develop an intuitive sense of how these types of stories tend to come together. But it's not often that people will kind of take a step back and think about, okay, writing is a craft. There are elements of crafting things with intentionality and having a level of intention in what you do. That doesn't mean you need to be like following a mathematical formula for each chapter or each arc, but at minimum, developing an awareness of what the toolbox is. I think it's not something you want to jump into before you started writing something, but definitely being aware that these things exist. And then once you've gotten a flow going in a story, and just being aware, you know, that there are tools like scene sequel or promise payoff or emotional anchoring or tension through lines, you know, just to rattle off some basic ones. And there are like, you know, advanced level 9000 author techniques that I haven't broached yet and maybe will never broach. But I think the basic understanding of structural elements is really, 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 really important. And you see a lot of people who, like you see some authors who have written 10,000 pages and they still haven't broached that subject. And they just know intuitively enough that they're doing it. But then as you get through people who release more and more things, some things will be a hit, some things will flop. And often it boils down to those structural elements. And because they don't know the toolbox, you can't break down why something works and why something doesn't. It's definitely something that I think more people should pay attention to. That's my first point, at least.
Let me try to contextualize it a little bit. It's kind of the reason why you don't try to learn swimming from Michael Phelps.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. This guy was basically born in water. You think you like water? I was born in it. Right. That sort of stuff. You learn from people who had to struggle to learn. Because they can like teach you all the nitty-gritty skills. There's very few people on this podcast, and I interview mostly people who are successful on Royal Road in some capacity, who have never written a book before. There are a handful. I think I can like count four from the top of my head. Was like, no, I've written anything before. My first book. I love that. This is amazing. They should keep doing that. I sometimes worry like, okay, what about the next book? Right? What happens when that story ends? Like, what's the next one? This is kind of sounds so pretentious, and I don't mean it in this way, but there's a certain argument to be made that, like, you're a writer when you write stories, but you're an author, you're a writer when you write like a successful story, but you're a successful author if you write two stories and three and four, right? Because like even Brandon Sanderson rarely ever like misses. Like all of his stuff is like on a base level very good. There's some where I'm like, I don't like this character, or it was a little bit flat, but
but they're good.
None of it is like, this is terrible. What are you doing?
It's just, it's a matter of taste rather than a matter of how the book's being made.
Exactly.
And I agree as well. Like there's a, something I joke about with a couple of author friends of mine, about noob traps. Noob traps. So like newbie author traps that they fall into. And like one of the biggest ones you see religiously over and over and over again is people thinking that you get better at writing by getting better at prose. When prose, like prose is the last thing you should focus on.
Yeah, so unfortunately.
You can look at, you know, you can look at Janjaya, you can look at a lot of web novels on Rory, you can look at most of the space we operate in, and there are really successful books that have mediocre prose, because prose is not how you write a good story. It's how you write a pretty story and an awful story, but it's not how you write a good story. A good story is down to the narrative structure and those more core baseline elements.
You're literally killing me right now. Nah, because like I love prose.
There's nothing wrong with it. I think it's just the I think especially when you're writing your first thing, it's like, this isn't going well. How do I make people like the book more? I focus on the line by line rather than the arc.
Oh, I never thought that.
Yeah.
The prose is really good. The rest is shit. Yeah. I'm kidding. Like, I mean, like if you like, this never really goes away on any level. If you're looking, for example, at Patrick Rothfuss, The Name of the Wind doesn't have a very good plot. It's like the plot is like all over the place, right? He pants the shit out of it. And it has no coherent like main storyline, and like no one talks about the second one because like the plot was even more meandering. But hot damn, I love that book. Yeah. Because like
there's no good tension.
Yes, and the prose pulls you through, right? So if this is going to sound like super weird, but if prose like mattered the least, no one would read poems. I mean, let's be real. The epic poem has kind of fallen out of favor as like a storytelling device. But there used to be a time when people literally, that was like the preferred thing, the saga, right? You rhymed. Or you focused on how do I express this same story in the most beautiful way possible. But that also was dictated by the fact that paper isn't cheap, right? Apparently, despite the idioms. You would write your stuff and you would have to make it as good as possible because everyone knew it was the same story over and over again. But in order to print it, it needed to have something extra and special. And that was the prose. In the web serial format, that doesn't matter. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing.
I think that way you can see it as well. It's like, I'm not sure if I agree with your point about The Name of the Wind. Mostly, and I do agree, has bloody lovely prose. And I'm definitely not saying that prose is pointless or that there's no reason to focus on it. I definitely tend towards a more utilitarian prose type, but I very much enjoy reading things with very artful prose. But what I do think is that, say, for The Man of the Wind, is that even if the plot is a bit floaty, to put it kindly, I think that, so what I'm referring to when I say structural elements is it's not necessarily the storyline itself. It's not necessarily the line level copy of the prose. It's the bit that lies in between where you have things like the bits that actually grip you about the writing, where you have things like, so scene sequel is a really good example of quite accessible structural elements that you can learn about, which is one I started off using intuitively and have now learned more intentionally. And it's a big reason why I think people keep telling me that I have like mastered the Tao of Cliffs. Like, I'm not intentionally putting cliffhangers there. It's that pretty much every chapter ends on either some level of realization, disaster beat, set up for planning, a decision-making moment. Those are like structural elements. And it's one thing I think that, from memory, I haven't read it in quite a while, the Name of the Wind does quite well. And I think it does have really beautiful prose, but it is also very much a page turner. And it's like you kind of like are like, holy crap, it's got you by the throat, and then you turn pages and turn pages, and then you're done, and then you finish, and you sit back and you digest it for a bit, and you're like, that was really gripping. It was also really beautifully written, but like
what happened?
What that was kind of dreamlike and surreal.
I think that's like the best way of putting it,
And you can see the books that succeed in spite of something, whether that is mediocre prose or a floaty plot or mildly bland characters. When you look at it slightly deeper, it's because they're gripping and they're page turners. And you get there through structural elements. And the way you get there through structural elements, a lot of people just use them intuitively. Is by understanding what they are, because like what you're saying about, you know, an author is somebody with more than one successful series. When you use something intuitively, you don't apply it consistently, which means that you
it's
can
like 10 finger typing. Right. Exactly. Like everyone can like type with the Eagle search and destroy method. But just because you know what a keyboard is and how you use it and you're using it every day doesn't mean that you're getting the most out of it. And if you're looking at like scene sequel, for example, or even plotting, or even pantsing, revising, rewriting, characterization, anything, it is one thing to know that these things exist. That is like level one. If you're going by the like guy with brain energy meme idea, but level 3 and 4 is like knowing not just why they exist, how you can use them, but also like how to get the most out of it. It's typing with 10 fingers and not just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or 7.
I agree. And I personally put myself somewhere on like 1.5. So I know they exist. I try to apply them where they can. A lot of my application is through implicit knowledge of just voraciously destroying content for many, many years. So like the basic premise is baked into my frontal lobe, but it is an active work in process to, you know, approach structure with more intentionality. I approach my writing with intentionality where I'm like, I'm trying to create this effect and then write to it. But sometimes, you know, the elements you use to create an effect can be applied a bit intuitively, and I'm trying to get more active and more intentional with that.
There's more we could talk about, but we gotta skip on to the next next question, because we're kind of already running out of time. So
certified,
what is it's fine. Like we talked at the beginning a lot about like books that you liked or love, like Spire Spite or Homunculus Knight. That rhymes, which is nice. But tell me about one book that you love and why is it awesome?
So if I was to refer back to the two of them, I think the things that I really like about the two of them are that they're both two examples of what I think call on some of the strong points of like traditional fantasy and traditional public fiction, and apply them with very little friction to you know, the progression fantasy space and the spurial medium. And I think that's a very hard thing to do. And it's really interesting when it's done well. In terms of, I guess, more popular fiction, Scott, give me 5 seconds.
Just saying, by the way, before the podcast, Bacon said, like, I don't need to prepare. I talk a lot for my job, so I don't need to prepare a lot.
And actually,
like, wait, let me just look.
No, I've got something that's jumped out immediately. So the Daily Grind, I think.
Is
by, something.
Quetzal.
No, by Argus the cat.
Oh, wait, that's Argus, right? Yeah, like they're. At some point they were dating, so I always mix them up.
So I've been following this book for years. Mm-hmm. And there's just something incredibly
grinding it daily.
I mean, for a while, absolutely. But there's something very satisfying about that book. And it's almost a deconstruction of what we like about lit RPG in certain aspects. And I almost see it in my head as like a proto super supportive in the way that it's structured. But the kind of three aspects I really, really, really like about the Daily Grind is one, it is pretty much the back rooms before the back rooms existed. There's something just like very funny to me when I realized that.
The back rooms. Liminal spaces. Mm-hmm.
I guess that liminality and like, especially in the early books where it was that like period of discovery, especially centered around the office dungeon where, you know, at 2 a.m. in the morning, there's a moment where you can enter this like strange, like twisted reflection of like an office space with like living staplers and dragons made out of tower computers, and all your rewards are like skill orbs that give you +1 rank and, you know, German automotive engineering specialized on like the 1987 VW Beetle or whatever. There's something very lackadaisical and silly about that. And then seeing it tuned into competency is very, very entertaining over long stretches of time. And the other aspect I really liked was the sort of bold-faced stance that it takes on some things. And like, this is what the story is about. It's not going to be for everyone. Don't care. I'm going to write my thing. In terms of its like portrayal of queer aspects also like, I think, portraying polyamory in a web serial format in the spaces we're in is a very daring thing, especially when it's like, two bisexual guys and woman. And it's like, hats off, dude. That takes some serious nets.
It's like, it's like, which difficulty would you like to choose for your climb on Royal Road? Yes.
Yeah. Impossible, please. Yeah. With extra pain. And it's successful in spite of that. It's always been a bit of a cult hit, but it's definitely a hit. And, you know, I go through periods of reading it, as I do with, like, more stable, long-running stories that have slow story arcs. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll let them linger for a year or two, and then I'll burn through, you know, 3,000 pages or whatever. But yeah, there's never been a moment where I've been dissatisfied with the content and been dissatisfied with the themes they explore. I think another one along those lines is probably the works of Arx. So Archandrist and Adam Bluff. I started reading Archandrist. I think I subscribed to his Patreon at like chapter 5 when he released that Admiral Road or whatever. And as soon as he released Adam Bluff, I jumped in. And I like those for the same reasons. They're like bold-faced, they're very well-written, and they're very interesting.
Indeed. So, next up, next question. Well, not really a question. It's more like the closing of the YouTube part of the show. Shout outs. You've given a lot already, but what are like two or three more?
Yeah. So I think probably the main one, I would say is probably the Council of the Eternal Hiatus. I jumped in with them months ago, actually. Just, you know, it was about 30 chapters into my backlog. I launched with 100, which was pretty psycho behavior. But so there was a good like 3 months there that I was in that space and getting to know people, asking stupid questions, trying to convince people to read my stuff, talking favorite chatting, and I've gotten you know, some really awesome advice over that time, and I've made some really good friends. And you know, if you're a writer who's in this sort of web serial space, or even just a writer in general, and you want like a welcoming community that's not very gatekeepy, and is very open and is very focused on the more craft sides of writing, rather than say, you know, commercials or whatever. I think it's a fantastic place to be in and a fantastic group of people.
Yeah. And you can find the link to that below the podcast. There is a link, I think it's called https://linktr.ee/critrpglinks. And you can find the council there, along with some other Facebook groups and Reddit groups and subreddits and whatever that you can kind of like look at. Well, Bacon, I think this is it for us for now, for the main show. We're going to keep talking for another, like, maybe like 15 to 20 minutes.
Fantastic.
After the YouTube part ends, or the free part ends, I guess. And yeah, any last words?
Hope you read my story and enjoy. Otherwise, if you're getting into writing yourself, I hope you enjoy that too, because it's a very fun process. And if you never get anything written, if you ever make it onto Rising Stars, don't be surprised by that. And I suggest preparing for it.
Yeah. All right. Well, with that being said, thank you everyone for listening and or watching. There's more stuff on Patreon that you can check out if you want, at least an hour for each hour of podcast that is freely available. Where we mostly talk about stuff that is unrelated to the main series, you know, like writing in general, or yeah, just hanging out. Anywhoozle. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time. Okay. And if you're on Patreon, the show goes on.